So over by the grace of God since January the 1st of 1973, for which I am grateful. My wife is grateful. My children are grateful. Lots of people that I dealt with are grateful. I want to thank the committee for asking me to come here. I told them I need a little water. I've got 3 glasses of water up here, so I guess that's how long I'm supposed to talk. Kind of losing my voice. Maybe it'll loosen up a little as we go along. I wanted to help Bob a little. Bob told a story last night about the genie. He didn't finish it. A woman alcoholic came along and rubbed the same damn pot. The genie popped up, got 3 wishes. She wished for beauty. She wished for wealth. And she was carrying her cat. And she hadn't had any companionship for a long time. And she looked at the cat and she said, "Well, I wish Tom was a 6'4", beautiful, handsome male." Shwoop. There he was. Just like a Greek god, you know. Muscles everywhere. Blonde-headed, where's Lee? She kind of ran her hands across his chest and she said, "What do you think, big boy?" He said, "I'll tell you what I think. I think you're going to wish you hadn't sent me to the vet to get fixed." Well, I'm an alcoholic, and I've told you that. I'm other things. I'm a qualifier. Some people have got a kind of bewildered look on their face, and I don't know what a qualifier is. But lots of you in this room are qualifiers. That's what they call you in the Al-Anon room. I'm my wife's qualifier. I didn't know that until recently, but that's what I am. I am also the adult spouse of an alcoholic. Of an Al-Anon, I'm sorry. Of an Al-Anon. The adult spouse of an Al-Anon. And as such, I am privileged to tell Al-Anon jokes and all that kind of stuff. I want to thank Ed for picking me up at the airport and Tom for all the nice things they've done for me. Bill took me around today and showed me some of your city, and I enjoyed that very much. It's a wonderful conference you have here. It's a privilege to be in any place like this to talk to a group of sober alcoholics and their families. We deal with a mystifying condition, old condition. Alcoholism has existed for well over 2,000 years. You can find it described in the Old Testament. And no one ever found a way to deal with it until Alcoholics Anonymous was really formed. Preachers tried. Doctors tried. All kinds of people tried to deal with this strange malady that the alcoholic has. Our book, with Dr. Silkworth talking, the doctor's opinion says that we have that we're different. In the book it says we're physically and mentally different from our fellows. It says that we have an allergy of the body, which means we don't react to alcohol, I think, the way other people do. When I take a drink of alcohol, what happens is it goes in my mouth, down my throat, hits my stomach. And you've heard a lot of drunks describe this. It's that sort of whoomp feeling. You get kind of warm all over. And then my stomach promptly sends a message to my brain and says, "I think we'll have another one of those." And another one, and another one, and another one until I've had way, way too many. Then I have the obsession of the mind. No matter how bad it was the night before, I have this obsession. You know what an obsession is? It's a great, big thought. So big it pushes all the other thoughts out of your head. And it says, for me, a drink would improve this situation. I don't care what the situation is, a drink would improve it. So I have the drink, the whoop occurs, the signal sent up, we'll have another one, and I'm back in it again. It's mystifying. Mystifying disease. It drives us crazy trying to understand it. It drives the drunk crazy trying to figure out why he does what he does. and it hides itself from the victim. We try to put the blame on everything around us more than we want to look at ourselves. When I was a kid, I was raised in West Texas. My granddad was a homesteader in eastern New Mexico and had the good sense to come over to Texas and buy some land over there where I was born and raised. And I was raised on this little farm. And we had a bulldog. My bulldog's name was Patches. He was mostly bulldog. And he was known in the community. He was a hero, sort of. He had fought and whipped a badger. The badger weighed 1 pound more than he did. We know because we weighed them both after he killed the badger. And he had a strong character. To demonstrate his character, every day for a week or so after he killed that badger, he'd go up in the field where the carcass was and pick it up and just shake hell out of it. Just to let the badger know if there was reincarnation or anything like that to come on back, he was ready. This particular day, he did something that I think describes alcoholism. He was laying in our yard, and he had no problems. He was a hero. He was well-fed. He was well-loved. He was accepted by the whole family. He had no competition. There were no other dogs around. And into our yard came the neighbor's boar hog. Big, ugly hog. Long yellow tusk on either side. Just ambled in the yard. And Patches made a bulldog-like decision to get hold of the hog. And he sailed out there and got hold of the hog. And he was growling and barking, and the hog was squealing, and my dad came running out of the barn to see what in the world was going on out there, and he was in the middle of them kicking hogs and dogs and cussing. I saw this going on. Worried about my dog, I sailed in the middle of that fray. Mother saw me going to it. Here she came. Everybody in the barnyard had a problem. Everybody had a problem. We all knew the solution. Patches, turn loose the damn hog. Turn him loose. But he didn't. Finally, he came off. And when he came off, the hog wheeled around and cut his shoulder and neck. And Dad caught him then and picked him up and was snarling and wanted to get back there, you know. And we took him over and put him under the water hydrant and cooled him off. And settle down. Get things quiet again, for God's sake. And we turned him loose, and he went right back and got hold of that hog again. It was the same deal. They were squealing and barking and kicking and cussing, and I'm in the middle, mother's in the middle. Everybody's got a problem. We've all got a problem. And everybody knows the solution. We all know it. Hog knows it. We know it. Patches, turn loose the hog. Well, he came off again. And this time Dad caught him again. And we recognized that Patches was not himself. I think the psychiatrist among us would say his emotional nature was in charge of his intellect. In the words of the common folk, he was crazy as hell. That's what he was. He was hooking up with something a whole lot bigger and a lot meaner than he was having no luck at all and was going back again and again. So we took him. When you get somebody like that, what do? You commit them. Some of you know that from personal experience. You get committed. We tied him to the water hydrant. Dad got in the pickup and drove the hog off. Removed temptation. Let him get quiet. Assigned me the job. I guess I was his counselor. I sat beside him and scratched his ears and petted him, and he got quiet. And in about 2 hours, I'd cured him. You could tell he was cured because he wasn't trying to pull on the chain anymore. He was laying there, had that bulldog smile on his face, little tongue sticking out, and little old tail was wagging, you know. So I went to see my father, and I said, Dad, Patches is all right. I've talked to him at depth, you know. Ask him deep and penetrating questions like, Patches, did you ever have a good day getting hold of hogs? What does your family think when you get hold of hogs? And he's passed all those, but he's all right. Dad checked him because he had a little bad luck with Patches that day. So he came back and looked him over and walked around him and scratched him a little bit. And he said, okay, turn him loose. So we turned him loose. He had to go 2 miles to find the hog that time, but he got him again by then. Most of you can identify with one of the players in that show. I was one of the first Hogganons in West Texas. A little later, I crossed the line and I became someone else. People began to tell me, Jerry, you ought to turn loose the hog. You oughtn't to get hold of the hog so often. You'd be a lot better man, father, lawyer, citizen, if you just leave the damn hog alone. See, that old, it wasn't the hog, getting hold of hogs, that wasn't the problem, really. The problem is not that we, that's a symptom. The problem was what sent him out there in the first place. The problem was what sent him back again and again and again when he was obvious he had something over which he had no power. And it was kicking the bejeebies out of him every time he got close to it. Turned out it wasn't hogs at all. A little bit later, he caught one cattle truck. Just one. And we have people here who catch cattle trucks. And we don't come back. Alcoholics Anonymous can't do anything about catching hold of the hogs. We assume everybody's turned loose of the hog. But we have a way to help people live so they don't have to go back. We assume everybody wants to stop, and we go from there. I didn't want to stop for a long time. I drank for a long time. I started drinking when I went to college. And right away, I discovered alcohol, and I liked it. I was raised on that farm during World War II, and I was about 11 years old. They put me on a tractor, and we didn't have anybody to help us, and I started being responsible. And I had a heavy lot of responsibility. I didn't feel bad about it. I just had a lot of responsibility, and when I got a chance to be irresponsible, I liked it. And alcohol helped that a lot. I could drink whiskey and didn't give a damn whether school kept or not. I liked to drive fast and drink and chase pretty women and all those things. I liked where we drank. I liked when we drank. I liked what we did when we drank. Man, I just liked the whole scene. I even liked the next morning when you had that quiz show, you know. First question, where are we? I didn't know. We'd have to put together clues to figure out where the hell we were. Followed closely by, what did we do? Now, we had to be careful there because there might be somebody looking for us. So we knew, excuse my voice tonight, it's rough. I've got some kind of allergy or something tonight. Anyway, I liked all of that. I just really liked the irresponsibility. And I liked drinking. And I, you know, you were talking about making speeches last night, I was standing on top of the house. My wife first recalls seeing me standing in front of the girls' dormitory at college, pledging my undying love to a dark window up there that I thought some girl, not her, was behind that window, threatening to jump off the porch, which is, you know, 3 or 4 feet high, commit suicide. Drunkard Cooter Brown. It takes a long time to overcome that sort of thing. I think now I got 4 glasses. I'll try. Thanks a lot. I had trouble with it from the very beginning. And I did all, what we all do. I did what I had to do to protect it. I wound up on the band bus one night, sick and drunk. More sick probably than they knew. They weren't as aware of how drunk I was, but a day or two later, the dean of the college called me in to the office and asked me what I was doing on the band bus since I didn't belong to the band at all. And immediately I knew how to lie. I said, oh, you know, I got sick at the football game and I was trying to get to my car and I reached the bus and cold sweat was pouring off of me, and I was shaking and shivering, and it looked warm in the bus, and I just crawled on the bus to get warm, and I guess I fainted. Next thing I know, I woke up. There I was, Dean. And she said, "Did you go to the doctor?" No, I didn't find it necessary to go to the doctor. Felt fine the next morning. Must have been some kind of virus, Dean. And, of course, they turned me loose. I went through a lot of different things. I used to be a heavy smoker. My wife and I married this girl that saw me doing that thing, pledging my undying love to that dark window. And that girl never did come out. I don't know why, but anyway, we got married, and I went to the Navy, and my drinking moderated, I guess, to some extent for a while. My wife was very important to me in college. I wasn't what you'd call a serious student. I didn't go to class often at all. And I needed my wife even then, because she took good notes in class. And we went to some of the same classes. And it's really helpful taking those tests if you know what the hell happened in those lectures, you know. So I could read her notes and take the test, and I'd loan her my car, and we were pretty good friends. And we got married and had a kid or two, and life was going along pretty good. I'm drinking more all the time. I've been to law school now, and I've got a law degree and got a good job, and I'm progressing as a lawyer. And we began to have some little incidents around our house. I smoked heavily, and my wife, I was an automatic smoker. I don't know whether any of you are that way or not, but I always knew in the middle of the night I could put my hand out and find my cigarettes and my lighter. I just knew where they were. And sometimes my wife put me to bed before she took me to the bathroom, and things like that, you know. And I would have to get up and find the bathroom. That didn't sound like a lot, but did you ever notice a similarity between closets and bathrooms? Well, I would find my cigarettes, and I'd fire it up, and I'd walk around, and I'd find it, whatever I found. And then I would come back, and I don't know about you, but drinking made me tired. And I would kind of lean back against the pillow and finish my cigarette. And there were, I'll just be honest with you, there were occasions when small sparks came off my cigarette and landed on the blanket and burned little tiny holes. Certainly nothing to get excited about, just little tiny holes. But my wife overreacted quite a lot. But with careful persuasion, I told her that, you know, that's why they have that pretty cover you put on top, to cover up little imperfections like that. This could happen to anybody. And, you know, that worked pretty good until one night I woke up and there was a good-sized fire going on my side of the bed. It's hard to explain that. If that ever happens to you, the best explanation I've ever heard is to tell them you think it was on fire when you got in there. Got the fire out. They talk about us today intuitively knowing things. I intuitively knew things then. I intuitively knew the next morning when I woke up I needed to get the hell out of that house as quick as I could. So I shaved, showered, went through the door, and as I went out I said, "Buy any kind of bed you want." I came home that night. She had bought a bed and had written me a letter. I don't know why she wrote me a letter. She knew I was coming home, but she wrote me a letter. She said, "Dear Jerry, I've been worried about your smoking and drinking. It's now reached the point when I can no longer go to bed at night without worrying about the lives of our children and myself because of your smoking and drinking. It's in your bag." Going to ring again. Anyway, she worried about my smoking and my drinking. She couldn't go to bed. She couldn't go to bed without worrying about that. And I told you I was responsible. I had this great sense of responsibility. She told me I needed to do something about that. I could see no way out. I had to deal with this thing. So you know what I did? I quit smoking. Never smoked another cigarette. Drank a quart of whiskey a day. Kept a pack of cigarettes on my table. Didn't smoke any more cigarettes. But that was the way my life went. My wife was, I said, oh, look, sensitive about drinking. Got really bad after a while, so I sent her to a psychiatrist. He agreed with me. She kind of overreacted, but he also wanted to talk to me about my drinking, and so I didn't go back to him anymore. I did a lot of things that were embarrassing to me. I went places and did things that just weren't cool. I had another occasion where I was at the state bar convention when I was a young lawyer and trying to impress all these big-time lawyers and judges, and it was in an old hotel where they had elevator operators. Pretty little girls. And I fell in love with one of those just like that. In the company of a lot of important judges and lawyers. And there I was, professing my undying love again, and embarrassed me to death. But my solution to that was to quit going places where I had been caught doing something I shouldn't do. And when you drank as long as I did, there was a lot of places in Dallas, Texas you couldn't go. I was worried to death I'd get a DWI. I didn't get one, but a lot of my friends did. So what I did, I ultimately wound up in taking my disease home. And I drank in my home, and nobody discussed with me how much I drank or when I drank. It was my God-given right to drink when and what I wanted to drink. And if you want to talk to me about how I drank, you better be willing to discuss the worst thing I knew about you, because we're going to get it all on the table. And when you do that to your wife and your children, they get a little sick, and they begin to abreact, and they begin to have problems. And virtually, they did kind of what I did. They began to leave me alone. I could go sit down in my green chair and just sit there and drink whiskey and dream wild dreams about what I was going to do to other people in the world, you know. And they left me alone. They stayed in the back part of the house. And then my wife did something that was just really pretty dangerous for us. Without my consent or knowledge, she began to go to Alma. And AA literature began to appear all over the damned house. And she had asked me questions. She gave me a little test one time, which, of course, I was smart enough to pass. It was written by some prohibitionist that didn't want you to drink at all. You could tell that. So I got through the test, and we fought endlessly about this thing. But then things began to happen to me that were a little hard to slough off. One of my partners came up to me one day and said, "Something's wrong with you." And I said, "What the hell do you mean?" He said, "You're white as a sheet." And so he said, "Go to the doctor." I said, "I'll check into it." And he said, "Now." I went to the doctor, and I was 3 pints low on blood. My stomach was bleeding. I had to stay there a day or two. And then I began to drink Maalox and gin. After I got out, that was not as good as you'd hope for, but it's a way to keep going. My wife saw me take my first drink after I talked my way out of the hospital, and tears were running down her cheeks. And I turned around and said something lugging to her, like, "What the hell's wrong with you?" And she said, "I just hate to see you kill yourself." And I said, "That's it. No more. No more discussions about my drinking. Shape up or ship out." I always gave her the option of leaving. I was the one who was going to stay in the house, because I didn't know where in the hell else I'd go. So I'd just tell her she had to go. She went to see her sponsor and decided she'd stay. I used to tell this is I was sitting in my house and had my dog with me. My wife had gone to one of those damn meetings. And I came to me that the only thing in that house that loved me was that dog. My wife came in and I said, you know, it's not right. It's just not right. I said, the only thing in this house that loves me is this dog. And everybody ought to have at least two things that love them. She looked at me and she said, I'm going to call my sponsor. She did. She came back in a few minutes and she says, my sponsor says you're right. We're going to buy you another dog. I didn't know she was going for a long time, but she wasn't there one night when I needed her. So I began to cross-examine her to find out where the hell she'd been. My wife's the most difficult witness I ever cross-examined. If she didn't want to give you information, it's just damn near impossible to get it out. And it takes a long time to do it. She came in this night and I said, where you been? She said, out. Out where? To a shopping center. Which one? Preston. What'd you do there? Met with some friends. Who were they? You wouldn't know them. What did you do with your friends? Oh, we just shared our experience, strength, and hope. So I realized I just kept closing the door and narrowing the gap and closing the door. And finally, I got this word out of her. Al-Anon. Al-Anon. What? What would be an Al-Anon? Al-Anon. Got kind of heated by that time, and I didn't want to appear ignorant. So I made my best guess. And I guessed it was probably an aluminum kitchen utensil of some kind. It isn't. She became very willing to talk to me all at once, and the information just gushed out of her. It was a wonderful organization. Everyone was welcome. Anyone who had a friend or family member who had a drinking problem was welcome. Bing, I'm the qualifier. I'm the ticket to this wonderful organization. I've been tried and convicted of alcoholism, but I haven't even got to open my mouth. They don't even know me, she says. But I know she's been telling them. She's been telling them. She's taken my problem to a public meeting. And I could think of thousands of people who might be there. Judges, judges' wives, lawyers, lawyers' wives, witnesses, clients. My God, there were thousands of people who could walk into one of those meetings, and when they did and saw her there, they'd know I was the only candidate for the qualifier for maybe 3,000 miles. And they would call my law firm. I just made senior partner in the largest firm in Dallas at that time. We already had two alcoholics. I'd heard them talk about them. I knew what we're going to do with them. We're going to get rid of them just as quick as we can. And they're powerful people. They have a lot of clients, a lot of years. And I won't last a minute once they learn out I'm an alcoholic. So I sobered up right there. I sat her down in the chair and I said, Billy, I got to explain this to you real carefully. Have you noticed that I'm the only one who brings any money to this house? She said, yeah. I said, do you know that we have a mortgage or a lien on everything we own? Furniture, the house, the cars. Yeah. Do you know what happens when you stop paying on the mortgages and the lens? What happens? Well, they come and get all that stuff. When they find out at that law firm that you're taking this my problem to a public place and talking about me being an alcoholic, they're going to fire me. The money stops. They come and get all of our stuff. We're not talking about college educations now. We're talking about standing naked with our children on the streets of Dallas in the middle of the winter. You mustn't go to that anymore. She said, Jerry, I think I need to go. I said, Billy, please do not go to any more of those damn meetings. And she said, Jerry, I'm going to go. And I said something loving like, well, I'll damn sure kill you if I ever catch you another one. And I didn't kill her, and she kept going. She drove me crazy. Every day I thought, today they're going to call me in and talk to me about this thing. I was worried to death. And I'd get home and I'd pick another fight with her, trying to get her out of Alma. I begged her, I threatened her, I did everything I could to get her out of Alma. She wouldn't go. If they get you for just a little while in Al-Anon, they'll brainwash you like you ain't ever seen. One night I was sneaking up on her. I was going to start a fight when she didn't know we were going to have one. I do that. The way you do that, you start off kind of friendly, you know, kind of loosey-goosey, and pat her on the bottom and say, how are you tonight? And, gosh, the supper smells good. How the dog? The cat? Where are the kids? Are they having a good day? Yeah. And I said, Billy, I've been thinking. I needed her to make some admissions so I could get this thing started. And I said, you think I'm an alcoholic? And she said, I don't know whether you are or not. I said, well, that's damn strange. You've been calling me an alcoholic for years. And she said, yes, but I was wrong. It's really hard to get something going when they're acting this way, I'll tell you for damn sure. She said, it doesn't matter what I think. It doesn't matter what your mother and your father think, the children, our neighbors, friends, your partners, your doctor. It doesn't matter. It matters only what you think. Because unless you believe you have a problem with alcohol, you'll never do anything about it. And I made a mistake that no good trial lawyer ought to ever make. I asked a question when I didn't have a goose's idea what the answer was. I said, well, if I wanted to find out if I was an alcoholic, how would I do it? And the jaws of the Al-Anon trap closed just like that. I had opened my mind just for a moment, asked a question I wanted an answer to, and they had me. She said, well, you could quit if you wanted to, but I don't think you want to do that. I said, no, I don't want to quit. She said, fine. She said, they tell me you can find out if you're an alcoholic by doing some controlled drinking. I said, what in the hell is controlled drinking? Believe me, I didn't know what controlled drinking was. So she said, well, they tell me if you drink 2 drinks a day, every day, don't miss a day, 2 drinks a day for 6 months, and you don't ever exceed that, you're not an alcoholic. I said, let me understand this. You've been trying to get me to quit drinking for years, and now you would like for me to drink another 6 months. Is that right? She said, yeah. And I realized I was dealing with a very sick woman. This conversation was going nowhere, and I got the hell out of there. And I sat in my green chair, and I began to think about this thing. My recovery started right there. That was the instant my recovery began. Because I needed to get her out of Al-Anon bad. And over the next couple of weeks, I thought about this thing, and the only way I was ever going to get her out of there and to save our family, somebody had to save our family, was for me to pass that damn test. Now, I decided I would take the damn test. I'd been thinking about cutting back. I didn't know anyone who drank as much as I did, or as often as I did. You couldn't drink much more or any more often than I was drinking at that point in time. So I decided, I'll take the damn test. I won't have to do it for 6 months. She'll notice it right away. She watches all the time. And she'll see that I am doing great. And those people in that Al-Anon deal are some kind of prohibitionist or some damn thing. And they'll let her off the hook. And she'll be able to quit going to those damn meetings. Now, so I didn't tell her I'm going to take the test. I didn't tell anybody in the world I'm taking the test. This is between just me. I had to change the test a little bit. Well, Two drinks didn't do me any good. No. But I had a pretty good sized glass. And I decided what I'd do is I'd drink two martinis before dinner. Then I would eat. And then I would switch to one brandy with a little splash of soda, because that's what gentlemen had after dinner. Then I would go to coffee. And nobody in the world but a prohibitionist could fault a man for drinking like that, particularly a man who had the kind of pressures on him that I had. So I started trying to do that. Really an interesting experiment. I would have one drink and begin to loosen up a little bit, you know. And I'd start the second drink, I'd get toward the bottom of it, and I'd think, well, that's about all the martinis today. And then it would happen. From way out in left field would come this thought. You know, they say alcoholism centers in the mind. Mine did. It would say something like, what are you doing? What are you doing? Are you over 21? Are you a man? Who has to go down and fight those little lawyers and battle in the courtrooms all day long? Who supports all these damn people around here? Are you going to let a bunch of little old ladies in tennis shoes tell you how to drink whiskey? The answer was hell no. Hell no. And I drink the bottle. Some days I'd go to the bar and I had a bad day. I just didn't want to screw around with the test. So I'd say there's no test today, and I'd drink the bottle. Some days I'd forget it. It's called purposeful forgetfulness. I would decide not to remember it, and I would drink the bottle. Always I would wake up in the morning, hungover, feeling bad, and wonder, believe that's got you again. Tell him we'll get to him later. Anyway, my wife had a sponsor who was not a kind woman. She did things that were really pretty cruel, mental cruelty. She told my wife that what she should do the first thing in the morning, the instant she became conscious, was to say, this is the day the Lord has made. I shall rejoice and be glad in it. Now, when you've had a quart of whiskey the night before, one eye's been propped open for about half the night. You have what I call dry socket. You can't open it, you can't close it. Your heart's thumping, your stomach's upset, your head hurts. And you hear your bedmate say, this is the day the Lord has made. You're reasonably sure you're not going to rejoice a hell of a lot that day. And I couldn't understand why I couldn't do this. I had a lot of willpower. I stopped smoking. All I'm deciding to do is just drink three drinks. It's the amount I set for myself. It's a reasonable amount. Why can't I drink three drinks? What's wrong with me? Good question. What's wrong with me? And that began to prey on me. I gave the test a good chance. I ran it a year and a half. Just to be sure there was no, it was a good constant test, a good scientific test. At the end of that time, all I could think about was drinking, not drinking. Wished I'd never had a drink. Wondering what in the hell was wrong with me. I knew alcohol had me. I didn't have alcohol. There was no question. I'd even begun to sneak drinks at the house. Something I'd never done before. And I was constantly aware of it. I worried every day about them finding out about me being a drunk at the office. I knew by now I'm a drunk. And I was running out of steam. On December 31st, 1972, I didn't have much on my agenda that day. The only thing I had to do that day was stay sober until midnight. Not sober, I mean on your feet, kind of functioning. I could drink. Everybody was going to be drunk. But we were going to go out to dinner, and then we were coming back to our house. I know why we're coming back to our house. Because when I get out, I'm hard sometimes to get back in. So we're coming back to my house. We're going to bring in the new year with a few friends. Everything's going to be rosy. And 1972 will be gone. And that's a good thing because I had worn that year completely out. Didn't want any more 1972. So I started out that morning. My wife warned me on my first drink. Remember, we're going out. I remember. So I paced myself that day. Was very, very careful. And I woke up in my chair. And I looked out the window and it was pitch black outside. I looked over where my wife's chair was, and she was sitting there in a robe reading a little book. They read lots of little books. And I said, shouldn't we be getting dressed to go to dinner? And she said, oh, Jerry, don't you know what time it is? And I looked at the clock, and it was about 10:15, 10:20 in the evening. I passed out at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I didn't have any excuse for that. I wasn't mad at anybody. I didn't have any pressure on me. I just done it again. And I was sick of me. Sick of what I'd become. I was so lonely at that point in my life. I didn't think anybody in the world had what I had. It was going on. I felt different. And I got up and went to the bar and I mixed myself a big drink. Because I wanted oblivion. I wanted out. They knocked me out. And I got up on January 1st, 1973, to the sorriest looking day that I have ever seen. I had no hope that day. I sat on the edge of the bed that morning and thought, okay, you got a new year. What are you going to do with it? How are you going to get along this year? What are you going to do about what happened last night? What are you going to do? And I thought about my options, and the only thing I could think of was to stop drinking entirely. Something I had promised I would never, ever do. But that day, it seemed like the only alternative I really had. So I took a shower, and I got up, and I went in, and I told my wife how sorry I was about the preceding evening. You know, I knew she'd had to call those people and said, we can't go to dinner. I know, by the way, you can't come over here either. And she, being an Al-Anon, probably told him because he's passed out in his chair again. And I was ashamed of that. Wasn't the kind of person I wanted to be. These were our best friends, maybe the best we had, because a lot of others had left. She wasn't impressed with my apology. And I said, I've decided that I'm going to try to quit drinking. And she was impressed. She hurried over to the bookcase and grabbed it. Just happened to have a copy of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Little 24-hour day book, and she came running over to me and said, would you like for me to call someone in Alcoholics Anonymous? And I took those books and said, hell no. Threw them against the wall. And I said, I don't know whether I can do this or not, but if it gets done, I'm going to do it. West Texas man, you know. Gets done, I'm going to do it. And you keep the kids and them damn AAs and the dog and the cat and everybody the hell away from me because this ain't going to be pretty. And she said something loving in Al-Anon like, you got it, and walked off. And I had it. I had declared a problem, declared I was going to solve it, and was left to my own devices. And I don't know how it was with you when you quit drinking, but things didn't improve right away. Matter of fact, the wheels came off. I began to shake and shimmy and got real quick. Couldn't be in the right place. If I was standing up, I ought to be sitting down. If I was sitting down, I ought to be outside walking. If I'm outside walking, I ought to be in the house laying down. I'm just moving and moving. Some of you have seen folks like that, I think. I didn't. Couldn't sleep. You won't believe that, but I couldn't sleep. And I watched people, and they were getting along fine. They were laughing and doing things, and hell, I'm just barely hanging on here. My stomach's in cramps and knots, and I'm sweating. It's the middle of first of January, you know, sweat's pouring off of me. I didn't last but 2 days. The end of the second day, I decided, well, I'm going to sneak in there in the kitchen. She'll let those books in there. I'm going to do a little reading about what those AA and A people would do. So I didn't have time to read the big book. I'm real sorry about that. But I didn't want to be caught reading anything. And I ran in and I grabbed the little 24-hour day book and I opened it up and saw it had a date on every page. And I looked at January 2nd. Looked at that page and said, alcohol has ruined your life. And I said, yes. Damn sure has. And it then said, this year we're going to give our drinking problem to God and leave it there. I can't tell you how disappointed I was in that. I've been looking for God all my life. The time I was a little old boy, I heard the preachers talk about him. Heard about the miraculous things, about people walking on water, bushes, talking, all kinds of things happening. Just as soon as one of those things happened to me, I was going to, by God, straighten up and do right. And I even cooperated. I went down to the front and got sprinkled and dunked and all those things they do to you. And I'm not knocking that, because that helps lots of people. They have legitimate conversion experiences, but I didn't, because I'm self-centered. I'm locked into me. I want God to prove himself to me, and then I might do business with him. Matter of fact, my prayer that day was, I didn't have anything else to do. I threw that book out in the middle of the table, and I said, God, if you're there, I'm going to give you this drinking problem. And if you take it, I may do some more business with you. It may have been the best prayer I ever said, because I knew I couldn't do anything about it. And the next morning, I woke up knowing something else that I had never known before. I knew I wasn't going to get sober and stay sober unless I had some help. And I needed some help with skin on it. Some people needed to help me, not some spirit somewhere. That's what I thought. So, I called Alcoholics Anonymous. Really a disappointing call. Got this lady on the telephone, explained to her that I was... had a little problem quitting drinking. Been drinking a long time and I was having some trouble with it. Wanted to know what AA and A did about that. And she said, well, how often are you drinking? I said, every day. How much are you drinking? I'm about a quart plus a few drinks at lunch. She said, how long have you been doing that? And I said, I don't know, 5 years, I guess. She said, you need to go to a meeting every night. And I said, that's impossible. I'm a very busy lawyer. I just don't have time for that kind of thing. And she said, well, what'd you say you'd been doing every night? I said, drinking. She said, well, you're going to quit that, so you're going to have some free time, aren't you? Then she began to discuss where I might go. And that was a big issue, because I had to be secretive about this, you know. I couldn't just go anywhere, for God's sake. We began to discuss what kind of requirements I would have where I went to AA, and I told her I would like to go to a place where they had college graduates. Close to a country club, so I could kind of fake where I was going if there was any kind of a problem. And she said, we ain't got none of them, so I knew I was in real trouble. Finally, I settled on a little home group. Went to a little home group a couple of times. They went once a week, whether you needed it or not. Had years of sobriety. I couldn't even believe they'd been alcoholic. Jesus, their baby had a year and a half. I couldn't think a week, and they were way out there. They didn't look like alcoholics. And then, about the third meeting, the miracle happened for me. In walked a guy from a treatment center up in South Dakota. Had letter tears sticking out of every pocket. Broken blood vessels all across his face and his nose. And he was quick. He was quick and I was quick. He knew more about alcoholism than anybody I ever heard in my life. Man, he'd pull out something, read it, put it back in his pocket. I followed him right out of the meeting. He had 6 months of sobriety. 6 months. And I went outside and I said, David, what do you think about this AA thing? And he said, oh, that little group there. I said, that's not for us. He said, we're going to have to get in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're going to have to go to meetings every night. We're going to have to get sponsors. We're going to have to do the steps, whatever the hell that was. We're going to make coffee. Whatever, I can make coffee. I don't know what good that does. But we're going to get involved with this thing because we're going to have to change the way we think. We're going to have to go to the basis of our mind and change the way we think. And I said, where are we going to go? The miracle happened there. And he came from out of town. He'd heard about this little group called the Alpha Group that Ed was talking about a minute ago. Now, I didn't just go out there. I'm a smart lawyer. And I cased the place just like I was going to rob it. I went down the street in front of it. It was over the top of a 7-Eleven or convenience store. First time I drove by, it was about 55 miles an hour. Just glanced over it like a I made the block and I came back and I pulled in and I went in, got a drink. But as I went in, I looked up the second floor to see if there were observers or television cameras or anything like that. Security system to see who was coming. Nobody was there. I got my drink, checked it on the way out, still all clear. Got in my car, backed out, and I noticed there was a driveway around the back. I thought I'd better see what's behind this place. Drove around the back, and there it was. There were 6 parking places in the alley. I could park in the alley and climb the fire escape and go to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the way I got here. That's the kind of willingness I had. But I was desperate beyond belief. I didn't like you even a little bit. I'd never seen a group of people like you. You walk in and people begin to grab you and hug you. I didn't know these people. They grab you and hug you and drink coffee by the gallon. Stand up behind a podium and tell the damnedest stories about themselves you ever heard in your life. Been in jails. Been in insane asylums. Lost families. Stiff creditors. And everybody, every time you told one of these bad things, they just laugh like hell. The most inappropriate sense of humor I'd ever heard in my life. But one thing I am, and that's competitive. I'll play, by God. And I got to thinking, well, I did a couple of things that were kind of cute. So I decided, well, I'll just tell them. And when I did, they looked at me and they laughed. And they said, look here, Jerry's beginning to open up. He's beginning to be himself. The only thing you can ever be is yourself. That entity that's sitting in that chair right now doesn't need anything added to it at all to achieve everything this program and God has to offer. You just have to stop doing certain things that are harmful and begin to do things that are helpful. And I was attracted into that way of life by people just like you. They were real. They were real. I remember one night a little lady, gosh, she didn't look like an alcoholic. She's about that tall. She was a librarian. And she got up at the podium and read The Velveteen Rabbit to us. It's a wonderful little story about a little rabbit that wanted to be real. And he became real. And we become real. Not many places in this world will you find people who have been able to sit down and share with one another some of the deep emotional feelings that they have. Tell them the thing about them that's unique, the way they've experienced life, the difficulties they've had. And we hear it all the time. It becomes commonplace. And we don't even really like to talk to the civilians anymore because they talk about surface stuff. And I went for it. I decided one time I'll try it. And I guess my third step was actually to mail a copy of the book Alcoholics Anonymous to my mother and father. They had told me over and over that I was running my life, that I was hurting my kids, my wife. And I mailed them that book, and I said, this is the way I'm going to try to live the rest of my life. And they thought Alcoholics Anonymous was the best thing since sliced bread. I had some wonderful experiences. I could sit here and tell you things that happened to me as I was on this quest. As long as you're trying, things are going to happen to you. Great thoughts are going to come to you. I went out, I've been sober maybe 3 months. I went out to East Texas to a little religious center for a weekend with couples. My wife and I were trying to put back a marriage. And I went out there and they had a Baptist minister who was going to lead this thing. That shows you how serious I was about this damn thing, because I'm a Methodist and I don't mess around with Baptists much. And this guy was a really bright guy, and he stood up and he started talking. And the first thing he said after supper was, we're all sitting on the floor in a little area. He said, let's just go around the room and tell each of you tell what God's doing in your life today. Testimonials. Baptists do that. Methodists don't do that. It's a very private thing to the Methodist church. Now, I wasn't going to do that, but I'm sitting on the floor, and the room door's over there. I'm going to have to get up, get on my feet, walk out of that room, and my wife is not going to go with me. She's going to sit right there by God. I know she is. And I'm going to make a spectacle of myself, and I don't know where I'm going to go after I get out of the room. So I think, surely somebody will pass. And they started around the room, and these civilians, they were all civilians, and they began to tell their little stories, just little sneaky stories, you know. And I got to think, you know, this is pathetic. These people haven't had any problems at all. Not like mine. If they knew about my kind of problems, like, you know, hell, I've been sober 3 months now. I'm a real alcoholic. If they knew that, they'd be impressed. I'd blow the socks off the Baptist. That's what I'd do if I told them. So I looked at all of them real carefully to be sure. I had never seen one of them before. And I decided I'll tell them. They'll probably want me to counsel with them after the meeting. Didn't hear anything for quite a while then, because I'm rehearsing my speech, you see. I want to do it just right. And then I saw a great big old boy got up. West Texan. He was about 6'4", 6'5", 230, 40 pounds. Had calluses on the back of his hands from dragging the ground. You know, one of those kind of guys. No lightweight at all, let me tell you. And he was bawling and squalling and blowing bubbles. And it was just pathetic what kind of an unmanly show he put on. And I couldn't understand a damn word he was saying. I didn't know what was wrong with him. And I figured this little girl sitting here next to me was probably his wife. And I was embarrassed by her. Finally, thank God, he sat down. And she got up. And she looked at all of us right in the eye. She had gray eyes like my mother's. She said, I couldn't do it without God. I couldn't do it without God. He sustains me every day. She said, the greatest thing about God is he's always been there, and he will always be there for every man, woman, and child. Just like our book says. She said, I won't be there to help my children who are age 2 and 3. But somebody will be. And they'll have an opportunity to find God and experience him the way I am. And my husband will find someone else to share his life with. Because God didn't make us to live alone. And that person will help him raise my children. And I'm so grateful we've got a good policy of insurance, so my last illness won't break him and break my family. And I realized I'm listening to a 32-year-old woman who's talking about dying in a month. She has children, 2 and 3. And she's talking about what God has done for her. At this point in my recovery, I'm feeling pretty sorry for myself. I'm not going to be able to go take my clients out for martinis anymore. No more long-stem glasses of wine in beautiful restaurants. I'm really feeling pretty sad about all this. I don't know what I'm going to do next New Year's Eve if I can't drink. And in that moment, I had a big thought. And the big thought was, If that lady had your solution, she's got an incurable disease called cancer, you've got one called alcoholism. But if she could have your solution, and the doctor said, I want to take both of your legs as well, she said, I'll take it, just like that. But she didn't have that option. And the words came to me, ain't you got it tough, cowboy? Ain't you got it tough? You've been sitting around here sucking your thumb, feeling sorry for yourself. And if she had your solution, she'd take it in an instant. I didn't make a talk that night. I didn't say a word. I don't even know how I got out of that room. I just know I was walking around the woods out there with tears streaming down my cheeks, just like that old big boy had, blowing bubbles, doing a very unmanly thing. But I wasn't crying because I was sad. I was crying because I was grateful. It had come home to me what an enormous blessing I had been given. That's the last night I ever felt sorry for myself for being an alcoholic. And I'm not sorry for you either. We've got a wonderful way of recovery. This thing keeps unfolding for us. We have the strength to do what we need to do. A few years later, my mother had cancer for a long time. And she and I were close. When I was on that farm, and 10 or 11 years old and trying to do a man's work, she'd come out there and get in a truck with me and help shovel wheat. And she's a little skinny thing and wasn't strong enough for nothing, but she was dead game. And she supported me always. And she had cancer, and she told me she wanted me to come up for surgery, and I didn't take a bottle with me because she never drank a drop in her life. And I went up there and I talked to her a little while, and she went into surgery, and they hadn't been in there any time. It didn't seem to me like when the old family doctor who was observing the surgery came out and said to my dad and my boys, it ain't no good. Said, there's cancer everywhere. She'll be dead in a year. And it's just like somebody turned a switch inside me. And I walked out of that room, and I walked out on that, got my car and drove to a liquor store. And I stayed there two or three more days drinking whiskey and vodka and coffee and all that good stuff, trying to play like I was sober. Everybody knew I was drunk. Mother came out of recovery. She knew I was drunk. Dad was drunk. They sent me home because I was no value to anybody. She took chemotherapy and it seemed to work. So for several years there, we thought she whipped it. Then one day when I was about 5 years sober, she got to call me again and said, they found another lump in my stomach. Come up here, I want you to be with me. So I went again, but this time everything was fixed. We were comfortable with each other. And I walked into that hospital room and sat down, and we visited for a while. And she said, Jerry, get the family in here, I want to talk to them. So I rounded up everybody, and she said, folks, I have been fighting this cancer for a long time. I'm older and I'm weaker, and I don't know whether I can do it this time or not. I'm going to try, but it's going to be real hard on me. And it's going to be real hard on you, too. And while this is going on, she said, lean on Jerry. He'll be your strength. And it was. I was. My dad blew a big ulcer right in the middle of that. He didn't even get to go to the funeral. My mother died after two horrible weeks in intensive care. You know, not one instant did they ever think about taking a drink. Not once. Alcoholics Anonymous and the power greater than myself did that for me. I didn't do that. It was beyond my power to do that. And I came away from there with the belief that God will sustain me in whatever I have to do. I don't know whether it'll all be roses or not. Certainly that's not anything I want to go through again. But I made it. I made it, and I did what I was supposed to do, and I felt good about myself when it was all over. And I was able to care for my dad, and I went on with my life. I told you I was real worried about my anonymity. I was scared to death that they were going to find out down that law firm. Just because I quit drinking wasn't any reason I quit being scared. Because I was going to AA meetings, and I was making talks, and I was looking over the room to see who might know some of our lawyers. Call them up, and I figured they'd fire me just sure as hell. And I was about 11 months older, and I decided, well, I was driving to work one day. I wonder why they haven't talked to me about this thing. And then the thought came to me. My paranoia took over. They know. They know. They're going to fire you at the annual partners meeting in front of everybody. That's what they're going to do. And then my competitive nature came out again. I said, damn if they will. I'll go on the offensive. I'll go tell them. They're going to fire me. They'll fire me before that partners meeting, by God. So I picked out five guys. And I went to see the five. They were the most powerful men in the firm. I went to the meanest one first. He managed the firm, and I figured if anybody's going to fire me, he will. He's got an instantaneous response to things, and he is not a warm and fuzzy person. I knocked on his door, and he said, come here. I walked in, and he said, what is it? I said, well, it is that I've got something I need to tell you. What is it? I thought maybe he'd say, sit down and have a cup of coffee, but he didn't say that. I said, well, it is that I'm an alcoholic. And I've been sober for 11 months. And I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm not telling you this because it's good or bad. I'm just telling you this because if you see me drinking again, some of our clients are in trouble. And if you know of anybody who ever needs any help with my kind of problem, I think I know how to help them. And I waited for his response. And he said, I am delighted. My God, we wondered what was wrong with you. He said, I heard you were on the water wagon, but I'm not impressed with the water wagon. So to get off and push. But you going to AA? He said, hell, AA, that's a wonderful organization. And he said, sit down in the chair and have a cup of coffee. And for a half hour, he talked about how bad that law firm needed me and what a bright and brilliant future I had. And he said, you know, Jerry, he said, there's just not anything anywhere you can't go here. We really need you. You notice we're sending you work again, haven't you? I said, yeah, I noticed. I was getting some pretty good cases recently. And when I walked out of his office, I could have whipped King Kong left-handed. I feared no man, my God. And I went and told those other guys. I went and told them. This the boss and I have talked this over. And here it is. I laid it out. I didn't care whether they liked it or not. And they all supported me, with one exception. One of the two alcoholics that I talked about was there. And he didn't want to talk to me about this at all. He wanted to talk about his ranch. He wanted to talk about anything in the world except this. And I finally said, you're just going to have to listen to this. And he said, oh, I know. I'm an alcoholic. But I'm not drinking right now. And I think I got it whipped. And I said, will you call me if you ever need me? I will, yeah. A little while later, he got in trouble. He got drunk. Got all his clothes off. Locked up in a hotel room with a whole bunch of important papers. Wouldn't let anybody in. And for an important client, we sent a team of lawyers down to Houston to get him out of that room and get the papers. And they got his clothes back on him and called me and said, Jerry, we're putting him on an airplane. He'll get there at 3 o'clock. When he gets off the airplane, he belongs to you. Do whatever you want to with him. So I sent him to treatment. He hasn't had a drink. He's 94, and he's never had another drink. That came to me because I broke my anonymity. There are millions and millions of people, 18 million who are still drinking, 2 million in AA. It's a lot of drunks. It's a lot of misery we're putting in the world. You and I are the ones who have the best opportunity to do something about that. We, for years, have had treatment centers that brought us busloads of them. In my area, they don't do that anymore. There are not many treatment centers left. So we got to go back to hunting drunks. Hunting drunks. Don't wait for them to call. Bill didn't call Eddie. Bob didn't call Bill. They were hunting drunks. They were contacting people. They were letting the fact that they were sober members of Alcoholics, sober alcoholics, and thought they had a solution, let that be known. That's the way we spread. If we hadn't done that, we'd still be meeting in a suburb of Akron. Because nobody would never got out of town. But a lot of really good men and women hit the road as salesmen and whatever and tried to reach the alcoholic who still suffers. Some of you say, I'm not ready for that yet. I'm just not ready for that yet. I couldn't do a 12-step call anybody. I might mess them up. Don't worry, you can't screw up a drunk. Bring him to the meeting. Bring him to the meeting. That's what you got to do. Get him in here. Give him a chance. Do you realize how blessed we are to be in this room tonight as sober men and women? Out of 18 or 20 million people, we're here. We're sober. We have a clear mind. And we can think our way through problems. We're given an outstanding way to recover. A program that will put you in contact with God as you understand God, who will enable you to do those things in life which allow you to be happy, joyous, and free. It all depends on you. It's up to you. My sobriety is up to me. I hope next year you have to put a double deck on this place to handle drunks. I hope you all got a new drunk sitting right beside you. You can tell that they're drunks. Men have got about, 3 days' growth of beard on their face. They have rusty zippers. It's a dead giveaway. They shake a lot and they don't know where in hell to go. And that's true of men and women. So God bless you for having this conference. Thank you for having me here. And you ain't got it so tough. Thank you.